So this is a session where we're going to hear from the leaders of the 18 breakout groups that were held over the last 2 days. They each get 4 minutes to present, so you're not going to hear about everything that happened in the breakouts, but hopefully you'll get a good idea of what happened and hear some interesting things that came out of them. Many of the breakout leaders sent me slides with a slide to thank all the participants and list them all, and I've ruthlessly edited all those out because as much as we want to thank all the participants, I don't want to spend a lot of time looking at slides with type too small for you to read and not see people's names. But I do want to thank all the participants. So there they are. You should find yourself there when you have time. And Elaine will be the first. You should know your breakout number and be ready. You can come on stage while you're waiting for the previous one to finish to be ready.
Okay. So we had a very interesting breakout session called The Science of Cryptocurrency. And to begin with, this is a little teaser. There's a very nice documentary about Bitcoin called The Rise and Rise of Bitcoin. So this slide is entitled The Rise and Rise of Cryptocurrency. Bitcoin, which is the first decentralized cryptocurrency, came alive first in 2009. And then it gained popularity pretty rapidly. And when I checked last night, each Bitcoin is traded at $284. This makes the total value of available Bitcoins at millions of dollars. And I looked up online at a website that lists the cryptocurrency startups. There are at least 551 cryptocurrency startups and at an average valuation of $3.9 million. Okay, so this cryptocurrency is entrepreneurs' favorite and also venture capitalists' favorite nowadays. And there are numerous altcoins that have been released, like Dogecoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, you know, I can go on and on. And then the large online service providers have already started accepting Bitcoin payments, such as Expedia, Reddit, Overstock, and so on and so forth. Okay, so with all of these exciting activities, we also have new challenges. Essentially, the usage of cryptocurrency outstrips our understanding of the cryptocurrency. And then this raises many issues. For instance, various attacks have been observed, like perhaps the most notorious attack is the catastrophic Mt. Gox failure. Okay, and then also there are several altcoins that came out, but then their designs were flawed, so they, you know, failed as rapidly as, you know, they came around. And then in the academic community, there have also been quite a few research papers showing various attacks against cryptocurrency. Okay, so if this is going to be the way of the future, then it will be imperative for us to develop a science of cryptocurrency to you know, get a better scientific understanding. And then obviously the first question we want to be able to answer is, what is the science of the science of cryptocurrency? And there are 2 points that we can try to address. One is, what are the main scientific challenges? And then the second one is, what makes this a science? And actually, this is a very nice question posed by Jeremy Epstein. Okay, first, what are the main scientific challenges? Okay, so the first question the breakout session we try to answer is, you know, what makes a cryptocurrency popular? So, for instance, Bitcoin became popular, but previously there were also other forms of digital money like cryptographic e-cash. So what makes Bitcoin particularly popular? And maybe to answer this question, we need to understand how to model user incentives. Another very crucial question is, how can we design a provably secure cryptocurrency? But to answer this question, we first need to be able to formally define what it means to be secure. So as I said, you know, a lot of the existing cryptocurrency, they have heuristic security. And sometimes, you know, if their design is flawed, there can be all of these attacks, which will have you know, financial implications to the users who are using the currency. Okay, how do you design a cryptocurrency that accommodates inspection and legal enforcement? For instance, law enforcement and policymakers, they want to be able to detect criminal activities, but cryptocurrency are By nature, they're designed to be anonymous, and maybe that's why one reason why they became attractive. So how can we preserve the anonymity, but then meanwhile maybe allow some form of inspection and legal enforcement? And then another interesting question is, how can we design technologies to help users protect themselves? For instance, let's say you develop smart contracts on top of this cryptocurrency, but as a user, when I see a contract, the contract can be maybe written by as a program on top of the cryptocurrency. So how can I make sure this contract is safe for me to commit money to? What if, if I commit money to this contract and later the contract is buggy, then my money can be lost? So I'll go over the rest pretty quickly. And we are also, another interesting question is, what are the theoretical characterizations of the possible applications and tasks? Okay, I will skip through the rest, and then the message for NSF. So cryptocurrency, a very exciting, the way of the future. It is imperative to develop a science for cryptocurrency, but we maybe also want to consider cryptocurrency in the broader form, not just like a single cryptocurrency as in Bitcoin or Ethereum. Thanks a lot.
Okay, so hi, my name's Ben Zhao from UC Santa Barbara. So I led the breakout on social networks and crowdsourcing. As I'm sure many of the other breakouts, we had a fairly engaging group, so it was actually quite a bit of fun. Didn't nearly get to the topics that we wanted to, but still fun nonetheless. So the initial challenge we posed to the group was, that the amount of current work in the space in terms of social networks and crowdsourcing content has been fairly focused around a couple of core topics, namely Sybil detection, fake identities on online social networks, and also the detection and elimination of forged content. So things like Yelp and Amazon reviews that have been either automated or paid for by potential attackers seeking to manipulate scores. So we wanted to see if we can broaden the research scope and to form something a little bit more cohesive in terms of both short-term and long-term research goals. So that was the initial challenge. And so our conversations sort of evolve around three different things, which I'll talk about fairly quickly. First, a lot of discussion on leveraging and managing the crowd. So the crowd in general, in terms of Amazon Turks and a rising number of other crowdsourcing websites, is a very powerful tool, right? It's a powerful tool for good. We've seen it in action in interesting applications that, for example, do real-time assistance for the vision impaired. You can do things like community-based phishing detection. And you can even detect fake online profiles by just using human inspection, something that goes beyond what machine learning tools can do right now. But at the same time, one of the other main issues we discussed was the rising challenge of malicious crowdsourcing and how to address those kind of challenges. In this case, we've got gray hat websites where basically the website themselves facilitate a marketplace between those who seek to manipulate or overcome standard use practices or terms of service on various sites, and then people who are on there as workers who are happy to do so for a small amount of money, right? So pay me a dollar to create a fake Facebook account or to write a very, very original and authentic negative review on your competitor restaurant across the street. So this is clearly an ongoing research challenge, and we didn't come across any really good solutions yet, but certainly machine learning has been mentioned in various contexts, but also the fact that these are human beings behind the attacks makes this a more adversarial scenario. And there are active people working in machine learning space on adversarial machine learning tools, but those are still in the development stages. So another discussion that we had was around content curation. And this is more to the point of how do we believe authentic information online from these crowdsourced sites, right? So this information can vary from product reviews to hotels and even stock tips online. And the question is, how do we ensure that users can really understand and appreciate the amount of trust or reputation or information or data behind each segment of such information, right? So there's this notion of transparency that really came up as throughout discussions, and it's clear that really in order for users to understand and to be aware of the risks, transparency is a key issue. And the next question is, where does that transparency come from, and how much transparency do we need? So one side of it, on the left side, you can have the providers provide less transparency. And the argument for this is the idea that providers like Amazon have access to large amounts of data hidden behind, servers that really is quite difficult to share with users in a clear way. And so if we allow them to take full advantage of that, let's say use complicated machine learning tools, various models to eliminate misbehaving users, et cetera. Oops, I'm hitting that lemon. Okay. So there's this negotiation between less and more transparency. And clearly, for users who want more transparency in order to better understand the risks, there's an argument for that. There's also social psychology arguments for more transparency. So what we really are looking for, then, is this connection, that's this sweet spot in between the two. So that seems to rely on some HCI work that may be currently going. And then finally, I'm not going to do this justice, is we need to educate users better on security on online social networks and hopefully make things go viral in a very folksy model way. Okay, I need to get off. Thanks.
Okay, hi, I'm Tal Malkin from Colombia. We discussed cryptographic assumptions in the real world. We interpreted cryptographic assumptions very widely to mean everything from complexity assumption to what power is available to the good parties, to the bad parties, how the protocol is implemented, etc. So we just tried to discuss the gap between the crypto and the real world deployment, and I'll say now the final thing I wanted to say, so I'm not so out of time. We came up with a lot of questions, not many answers, and our recommendations are the following. Think about these questions, do research on these questions, and fund researchers working on these questions. Okay, so I tried to group, our discussion was all over the place. I'm missing some things, but I tried to group them into categories. One is matching cryptographic models to the physical world. So one issue is side channel attacks, which actually people have researched a lot, but still there's a big gap between theoretical models and practical attacks and countermeasures. The other idea that came up is theoretical modeling and building of secure cryptography over vulnerable hardware, such as Trojan hardware. And we discussed the underlying physics and underlying physical assumptions of how do we model what it is that we have from the physical layer and what we can do with it and what do we need from it. And we discussed various examples such as noisy key agreement and paths and understanding randomness, like what kind of randomness are we getting and what do we need. The next thing we discussed, there are several issues for basic crypto research with an eye towards the real world. One thing is cryptographic complexity assumptions. How do we validate assumptions? How do we make sure we work with appropriate assumptions that are not broken? We discussed the need for more research on foundations on symmetric cryptography, making it less ad hoc and more rigorous, understanding better primitives like block ciphers and hash functions and the random oracle model, having weaker assumptions, etc. We discussed secure multi-party computation. This is an area that had a lot of research and yet doesn't seem to be used in practice, which was surprising to some of us. And the question is, why? Are we solving the wrong problems? Is it economic considerations? Is it on the verge of being widely deployed? Are we missing the right application, et cetera? And there was discussion of power-aware cryptography, which is mostly minimizing communication complexity. We then discussed employing crypto in the real world. These are just two examples. Sometimes we have solutions that we know how to solve in cryptography, and yet there are many, many, many problems when you try to use them in the real world that come from complexity. So one issue is the Internet of Keys, Internet of Things key management, and I'm talking about both private key and public key. And a completely different kind of problem is large systems like TLS, where we still don't have a security proof for the whole complex protocol. We then discussed new dimensions beyond cryptography. These are things that are traditionally not cryptographic, and indeed most security problems in the real world, or many at least, are often due not to crypto, but to poor implementation or misuse or other software engineering issues. And the question is, where is the boundary with the crypto? I'll say more about it in a minute, but the other issue is simplicity of implementation and use is often more important than just efficiency for real-world deployment. And the question is, these are not crypto issues. Can we make them crypto issues? Can we have rigorous crypto models for this? Like, can we have misuse-resistant crypto or something like that that will help address these issues? There are also questions about the way, the traditional way we do crypto, is Kirchhoff's law really good? Should we really believe it? Maybe security by obscurity is not such a bad idea. Let me skip this. So that's my last slide. Meta issues, let me put the whole slide on. So the meta issues, how do we incentivize researchers to do the right thing, where the right thing is more interdisciplinary research that will help solve all the problems we said before, and more long-term research. Okay, we discuss how we do it. Do we over-publish? Is there too much of a push to publish too much, too fast, instead of focusing on long-term research? There was a suggestion for interdisciplinary research by Joan Feigenbaum to submit real-world crypto proposals to algorithms in the field. That's an NSF program. And finally, crypto education can help. Thanks.
Hello, I'm Reza Dok from Stony Brook University. I'll try not to be cowed by the bell. So here's a summary. And the colors are completely intentional. I'll start from right to left. We are lacking in having security regressions that we can test how good our systems are. We are lacking in quantifiable metrics that we can accurately compare systems. In order to get those, we need tools and techniques that have to be developed. In order to get those, we need to have better understanding of the attack knowledge and lots of data sets to analyze. So, attack knowledge. There's a lot of lacking in the basic principles. There's still lots of things we don't know, the so-called unknowables that we need to have. We need a comprehensive list of the attacks and needs to be continually updated so we are staying as current as possible. Companies don't want to disclose a lot of the details and their internal architectures, which are critical for us to understand. Somehow we need to incentivize us for that. And we need to understand the interactions between people, hardware, networks, which means a lot of interdisciplinary work that's needed. Data sets. There's some data sets here and there, but the general consensus was that they tend to be old or synthetic and small, and there's still lots of areas where we don't have them. Worst part is that a lot of these sets are so heavily sanitized that essentially makes them useless. So we need lots of new data, minimal anonymization or configurable ones, somehow get to the access of the data. One idea was maybe some sort of an incentive like an IUCRC model. You contribute yours and then you get access to a lot more. Regressions. We have red teams, you know, people you can hire. There's some static code analysis, but we don't have sort of comprehensive tools that we can kind of press one button and it goes off and does everything you want to do. A lot of these types of suites will have to be different for different domains and customized, because what you would do for network routing will be different than an SQL database. And again, these need to be comprehensive and continually updated. We think that the way to get to that requires some sort of a community effort with open access, or the sort of the Linux model, everybody contributes a little bit and everybody benefits. Metrics. We know how to measure performance, energy, you know, supposedly easy metrics. When it comes to security, there's sort of these coarse classifications that are sort of you either in that class or not, but very hard to compare. So a lot of metrics that were proposed have to do with, for example, what about the TCB size, code complexity, which might correlate with security. How about time things, time to recover, time to break, resources to break, CPUs, machines, people, or maybe the number of infected machines, the amount of lost data. Cost in terms of dollars, I think, is an interesting way, because you can compose a function that integrates a lot of metrics together. All together, and we think that these combinations are really going to be very important. We need to develop the tools and techniques once we have all these pieces before. So we need, first of all, an inventory of what's available. A lot of people felt that we don't even know what's missing. So once we inventory everything, maybe then we can identify the most critical gaps. The tools need to be timely. Otherwise, you know, they're too late by the time they're developed. We need to develop sort of a very rich set of tools and techniques that will be easy to port or to apply to new problems very easily. Obviously, we need to do a lot of work on reducing false alarms and collaborate with lots of other fields, not just within CS, but outside CS, because cybersecurity is really a problem that's spanning all of society. And finally, to the funding agencies, the benchmarking in general of cybersecurity or anything is much bigger than just SATSE. It's something that should just happen across the board. Somehow we need to give incentives to people to develop and release a software, not just get the paper, publish it, and then move on to the next paper and not really sort of follow through. So more of the transition to practice will be really helpful. We'd like to get access to a lot of information, for example, Black Hat and so on. Somehow figure out incentives for how to incentivize a community and people to collaborate and help and share information that they're reluctant to share. We hope to see more of mention of these topics of benchmarking in the grant proposal guide and calls for proposals. And we noted that there is this BRAP program, which is focusing more on scientific application, but maybe something like that for SATSE will be useful. Thank you.
Our panel dealt with cybersecurity in the social sciences, and the most useful part, I think, to report is about collaboration. And we have some advice about promoting collaboration between computer scientists and social scientists. You've heard many examples of the calls for such collaboration and the need for interdisciplinary work, the importance of the fact that part of the system is sentient, and that's what social scientists specialize in studying. First piece of advice, if you're going to do a collaboration with social scientists and computer scientists, is start with both sides present at the start. If you bring in the other side halfway through the game, it's going to be much harder to integrate and much less valuable in terms of knowing what the issues are that and the process that you'll need to develop. So start by bringing in the other side as early as possible. Secondly, it really pays to be explicit about the goals and expectations, for example, on publications and fundraising, that the two areas are really quite different. For example, as you may know, in social science, the major form of credit taking and is publication in journals, and in computer scientists, it's through conferences. And therefore, it's important to make sure that both sides understand how they're going to proceed and what is going to be the expectations for participation and credit taking. And of course, fundraising is different because most social scientists, as individual researchers, usually have one or two graduate students and don't have the same scale of fundraising activity required to support their work as do many computer scientists. The hardest part is to get people to talk across boundaries and understand each other. And one specific suggestion was to organize brown bags across departments. This could be done in several different ways. One would be, say, a computer scientist that's interested in recruiting some social scientists to take part in a project to go talk in brown bag series organized in a social science department. Introduce yourself, tell them what you're interested in and why social scientists are likely to be helpful and see if you can recruit some. Or alternatively, social scientists go to computer science meetings. But even better would be to have a series of brown bags that are explicitly between departments where the topics cross between computer science and social science and are regular getting to know you each other and getting to know your research. It takes a lot of trust to do that because people talking to other audiences don't want to look silly and they don't want to look too jargony so that their work might not be well understood. But it's really worth the effort. Now, we talked a good deal about how do you do this communication between disciplines, And obviously, the most common and useful model is to have people with PhDs from different fields. Another way, though, is to promote education across fields, and we've discussed it. You've heard a number of ideas about including some policy analysis work for computer scientists and training some social scientists and policy types in some of the basic technology of computer science. But we want to point out that there's some problems that that should be avoided. And one is the potential for joint PhD programs is substantial. There are many. Information science, and to some extent, is one of those, and environmental science and others. But there's a real problem that you should be aware of as an advisor to students, or if you are a potential student yourself, that the joint PhDs in these programs tend to have limited job prospects because most of the jobs are in the standard, like well-established disciplines, and people with joint PhDs are often not strong candidates for those jobs, even though they probably should be. So that's a warning. And our final warning is about joint appointments. It makes sense on the surface to have somebody who is hired to be both, say, in an economics department and a computer science department. But the experience of many of us have been that for untenured faculty to have two different tenure review criteria is very dangerous. It's not just double jeopardy, but it leads to inconsistency about what are the goals and metrics of success are so different. And therefore, even for somebody who wants to do interdisciplinary work, it probably pays to have a single tenure line. So in summary, promoting collaboration is valuable, but it's a difficult process, and we hope that these pieces of advice will help you overcome some of the barriers. Thanks.
Thanks. Wendy Seltzer from World Wide Web Consortium and MIT. We had a lively discussion on how should the research community respond to the NSA revelations, and should our research change with new or expanded topics of research, changing research methods, and participation in public discourse. This wasn't a political discussion of was Snowden right or wrong, but given the way public trust in security and privacy has been undermined by disclosures, what should we as researchers do to help restore that trust in the security of our systems? And so the research subjects that we discussed, the topics broke down roughly in categories of definitions and policy around privacy and security, technology and systems and institutions. So among the definitions and policy, I hope these slides will be available later so that people can go through more of the detail that we captured. We improved threat modeling to understand the scale and scope of attacker capabilities and to help the users in identifying the threats that they face. Contributing to ongoing public discussion, in particular around what can metadata do, and what are less intrusive means of capturing information and going after targeted information, so that to say just metadata is still capturing a lot of information, and moreover, there may be less intrusive means to go after the bad guys while preserving the privacy of the good guys. We talked further in the technology and systems category about building systems that are resilient to against coercion or legally imposed intervention, decentralization. We started to move into multidisciplinary areas of research, combining the legal and sociological research with computer science to understand are the warrant canaries, the posting of, we have not yet received a request to turn over information effective? Is jurisdictional diversity in hosting effective? Is additional research in crypto and institutions? How can we design systems that are appropriately subject to oversight? Why did oversight break down, and how can we improve both our surveillance and our democratic control of surveillance mechanisms, including research on norms of organization, communication, and breakdowns, understanding the interactions between norms, laws, and technology. On research methods, building in security, we don't say stop cryptanalysis. Think about protecting research subjects. And finally, public involvement is an important follow-on to this research. It's not enough just to do the research. We also need to be presenting that research to policymakers, saying that protection of privacy is in the national interest, and disseminating that across the communities, demonstrating transparency best practices in our research. Thank you very much.
Okay. In our breakout session, we discussed cyber experimentation of the future. This is based on a joint venture between SRI International and USCISI. Just a little bit of background so you understand where we're coming from. Researchers require a whole host of infrastructure to support experimentation in their research. And this is not just test beds. It's tools and methodologies that help with all of the phases of the experiment lifecycle. And we currently don't even have the infrastructure that we need to support today's research. Lots of time and money is spent building this stuff, and it slows down research progress. But to complicate matters, we all know that computer usage is growing exponentially. Embedded computers are becoming pervasive in every aspect of our lives, and this is resulting in an evolving and growing risk to all of us and to our very society. Pramod and others have referenced this over the past few days, so I know I'm preaching to the choir here. We need to move quickly, or we believe that we need to move quickly to create a shared community resource that will help us understand the behavior of large-scale complex systems and enable interdisciplinary collaboration. We believe these things are core and needed in research moving forward. And Daniel had discussed this morning, if you recall his talk in his keynote. So to that end, we conducted a study that involved a large cross-section of the community of people to understand what are the future hard research problems, what will we need in the way of research infrastructure to support our researchers as they look at these challenges and try to find solutions, and what do we presently have that we can build upon that will enable us to get there more quickly. Our end goal is to produce a strategic plan and a roadmap for developing this infrastructure needed to support researchers such as yourself. I think I went too far. All right. So what are the objectives of this future research infrastructure? The first thing is it needs to catalyze and support research. It should not get in the way of the researcher. It shouldn't edict to a researcher how he needs to do his job. Rather, it should help the researchers become more effective, help them to fail quickly and move on so they can more quickly converge on good solutions to real problems. We believe it needs to provide revolutionary methodologies and capabilities that go way beyond today's current state of the art in order to support multidisciplinary, cross-domain, complex, extreme-scale experimentation. And it also needs to be broadly accessible. It can't be behind closed doors, it's got to be open access, and it cannot be cost prohibitive. So with that in mind, we briefed the effort, we talked about our high-level results, and we wound up having a very lively group discussion that actually validated much of what came out of our study and helped us understand the particular aspects that need to be highlighted in this report that we're currently working on and hope to have out, I believe, in the first part of February. or at least the draft. So some of the things that we talked about included experiment methods and the things needed to support reproducibility, the need for education. It doesn't do any good to give people these tools if they don't know how to use them effectively to conduct sound scientific experiments. There was a lot of other discussion, but that should give you a flavor. So I'd just like to leave you with this. So science-based experimentation infrastructure is critical. We have to have it or we can't do our research. And that's both now and in the future. We need revolutionary capabilities in order to get the advancements that we need. Our breakout session we thought was very beneficial to us. I really want to thank everyone who participated, not by name. And I want to leave you with this as a thought exercise. How would you as a researcher contribute to a community effort to build a large shared research infrastructure that can help us all move further faster?
So I led a breakout on developing a principled security curriculum, and our guiding questions were, what should a security curriculum cover, and how can we improve how security principles are taught? We had a pretty wide-ranging discussion, starting from the really sort of building on the panel discussion that had taken place the day before, about who are you teaching and what do they need to learn, and that's really the framing you need first before you can get into any kinds of specifics of what you want to do. And in particular, we agreed that there should be many different kinds of programs. There are both different audiences coming in, and I should say we mostly focused on sort of the undergraduate experience for the purposes of our discussion. Of course, you could have a similar discussion for other educational levels. But so people are coming in with very different backgrounds and experiences and interests, and also people based on those interests are looking to go to different pathways going out. There are many kinds of career pathways for people with cybersecurity expertise. And so we think that this is a good thing, that it's good that there are concentrations or tracks developing out of different majors, including computer science and information science, but others as well. There's also standalone cybersecurity majors. And that this is, again, is good because it develops potential interest in different kinds of career paths. And then only, you know, sort of understanding that landscape and reality, did we think you could get to the principles. And in particular, it may be that different principles are suitable for different groups because the area is so large that you can't teach everything to everyone, at least in a fixed amount of time and context. And there are also some philosophical questions unresolved about how the best way to teach is, in particular things like attacking, you know, building versus breaking, and the role of attacking in an educational setting. And so I think there's some differences of opinions on whether practicing offense is necessary if what you want to do is understand defense, or if offense is its own specialized skill that you should only learn in that context. I think there are people that would argue on both sides of that question. And then there are, of course, substantial pragmatic concerns and constraints in an undergraduate curriculum setting about overfilled curricula, long prerequisite sequences that put people only getting the knowledge that you cared most about too late in the sequence for them to do more with it, students coming in with varying backgrounds, et cetera. We noted that there are a lot of existing useful resources that should definitely be built on and not ignored, among them the ones listed here, the NIST-NICE framework, the recent National Academies report, the Centers of Excellence and the criteria for those Centers of Excellence, some work coming out of the military academies, and lots of things that are resources that are already available online freely, and others that I'm not stating here. And in particular, a lot of the work of the NICE framework really sort of lays out many, many different components of cybersecurity and things you would want to teach, and is a useful context for sort of exploring the audiences coming in, the pathways going out. And then, you know, coming to principles, which was one of the focus points of our breakout, as well as practice and mindset, even so how do you know what a principle is in our context when you see it is unresolved, but definitely the idea that they're going to come across different disciplines. So there are scientific principles that should be relevant, engineering principles, social science principles about how people behave, theories of behavior, among others, and that we think the principles are most effective when combined with practice. So you use those to illustrate the principles, bring them to life, to build interest, to encourage engagement, and thinking in that undergraduate context, we thought, you know, maybe the most important thing is a broad education rather than training for specific skills, but using the context of cybersecurity as a way to choose what are the principles, what are the practical things that you involve as you're teaching problem-solving, communication, and critical thinking, while developing a mindset and a culture and a body of shared knowledge that represent what is important in cybersecurity. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Christian, Carnegie Mellon University. I was leading the breakout on user authentication, and we basically started with a bit of a reflection on why is it that so much research on user authentication in the past couple of years seems to have been centered around passwords. As we know, user authentication and passwords are, I mean, passwords is basically an interesting field of research, but it's a subset of all user authentication. So one of the questions that we started with was, why are we still stuck with passwords when pretty much everybody seems to agree that they're actually a pretty terrible authentication mechanism? And the consensus was that they're actually not a terrible authentication mechanism at all. They're actually pretty good. They're essentially a little bit like a standard. It's something that everybody agrees it's bad, but everybody agrees that it's doing the job. And in particular, our passwords are simple, cross-platform, and perhaps the most dominant feature is that they're one-size-fits-all for human-to-machine authentication. So we agreed that we'll probably still be talking about password in a few years. Especially their success was conditioned by the fact that alternatives like biometrics historically had very poor usability. You could get very good biometric authentication maybe 5-6 years ago. It just was extremely expensive. However, this may be changing. So for instance, recent advances in, again, hardware make it possible for cellular phones like the iPhone to essentially use biometric authentication that is actually pretty usable. We were talking about results of a recent study that shows that people are happy about it. We may have qualms about the privacy implications, but in terms of usability, this is apparently a worthy development. And also, another point that was made is that human-to-machine authentication is actually not going to be the most dominant form of authentication in the coming years. We are going to talk more about machine-to-machine authentication. So things like the hotel, the card that you're using to get into your hotel room in this hotel is actually an RFID. It's authenticating the bearer of the card to the room. So there's going to be more and more of these things, machine-to-machine authentication. Also, we noted that there's a clear emergence of single sign-on systems like, the Google single sign-on and the Facebook single sign-on that people are using. So then we wanted to also list some of the future research directions that we see in user authentication. And in the context of machine-to-machine authentication, there is a question about how to do group signatures, pseudo-identities for a very large system, like transportation systems. We also noted that it's important to reconcile threat models with deployed primitives. For instance, why do you have to authenticate to your newspaper? You probably don't. And there's probably, if the newspaper wants to track you, there's probably different mechanisms that they can use than an authentication primitive. We highlighted the fact that there's still going to be a lot of work on user authentication because it's basically more or less an arms race, and this is something that people working in biometrics know. Have fingerprint-based authentication? Well, you can try to fake the fingerprint. Then you need to have an actual finger. Okay, well, you chop the finger. then you need to have a proof of liveness that the finger is actually attached to an existing arm, and so forth. Finally, we also highlighted the fact that it's important to decouple identification from authentication. We think that there is definitely more work that needs to be done in decoupling those. And we also wanted to highlight the fact that we need metrics to actually evaluate authentication systems beyond going for false negative, false positive rates. Scope of the threat model, adoption rate, and so forth are all important. And finally, we had a note about the deployment of forward secrecy, but there was no consensus whether or not there was still interesting scientific research to be conducted, or if it was just a matter, just being in quotes, a matter of having the engineers actually deploy systems that allow for forward secrecy in deployed authentication practices. You can ignore the last bullet, that's a leftover and a mistake. Thank you.
All right, so we were charged in our breakout with bringing about an end to silly vulnerabilities. Let me open by confessing that we did not succeed in the 90 minutes in bringing about a complete end to silly vulnerabilities. But we did come up with, I think, some interesting suggestion in terms of research, education, and incentives that will bring us closer to this goal. So first, let me formally define what I mean by a silly vulnerability. And a silly vulnerability is one where when you figure out what it was, what the mistake was, you do this. And this is when we realize that in some sense, all vulnerabilities are silly. I mean, when was the last time when somebody told you about some vulnerability or exploit, and you're like, well, that was a pretty clever mistake. I wish I had made that. So all vulnerabilities are in fact silly. And if we want to end silly vulnerabilities, we really have to end all vulnerabilities, period. And 2014 was in fact a banner year for silly vulnerabilities. In 2014, I think vulnerabilities really in many ways meant mainstream. In 2014, vulnerabilities got their own logos. They came pre-installed on every device. They have valuations of, you know, $1 billion or more. So I think, I mean, if these were startup companies in the Bay Area, venture capitalists would be like tripping over themselves to invest in vulnerabilities, as it were. So to motivate discussion, I proposed a resolution. I said that, in fact, we really don't need any further advances in research or education. In fact, it's entirely on industry at this point to solve the problem. So just stop funding us. This was somewhat controversial, and there was a proposed modification, which is that, in fact, it's entirely on the users at this point. This was also somewhat controversial. So then we resolved to make some specific suggestions for research, education, and incentives. So in terms of changing research, and I don't know why, it looks like when I converted to PowerPoint, some slides went out of order. So this is the product line for the vulnerabilities we see. These were supposed to be like five slides ago. All right, so in terms of changing research, there was changing directions for static analysis. So static analysis, if you're not familiar with it, is about scanning code without running it, looking for vulnerabilities. And we felt that this is a promising approach, but it's perhaps not the silver bullet we thought it might have been. But we made specific suggestions on how to improve it. Curiously enough, the first suggestion was actually that we need better usability in these static analysis tools. And I actually, as a developer of these, agree that we do need better usability in these tools to get them actually out there and used. And then there were the usual complaints about these tools, which is that they're not scalable enough, they don't go work on large code bases, and of course we have to decrease the false negatives and false positives reported. But this is certainly an approach still worthy of considerations in actually making a difference out there today. We just need to push it further. We felt that formal methods has a long way to go as well, in the sense that it's showing some promise, but again, it's even less scalable than static analysis. It doesn't apply to very large systems yet. We don't have full formal verification for reasonably large software. So anything to improve the scalability here would certainly help, and anything to bring down the cost in terms of both the expertise necessary to use these tools and the time it takes to verify systems formally would be incredibly valuable. Certainly, we had some suggestions in terms of programming languages themselves. So, and I think that sort of the first suggestion was, well, why don't we just ban C and C++? And I think we all agree this would be great from a security perspective, although it's not going to be a panacea. Because if we look at it, about half of vulnerabilities would go away overnight if we could do this, but there's half remaining, which is still lots of vulnerabilities. And it's not to say that there's not a lot we can't do. I mean, we can do a lot with language design. We should do a lot with language design for preventing vulnerabilities, but it by itself will not be a silver bullet either. In terms of changing education, I think it's important, or I think we all agree that it's very important that security be both a cross-cutting concern and a standalone course with its own emphasis. So cross-cutting meaning when you're teaching a topic related to security, you should teach the security at that point. And at the same time, you should also include security in its own course. And I think it's critically important to have security from the start when you're doing these sorts of software security-oriented education, that you can't add security in after you've already built your software. Finally, we considered incentives. In particular, we considered the construction of a Cyber Ralph Nader, in which he would bring about the civil liability laws for software developers so that if software developers introduce a defect or vulnerability, they could be taken to court over that. I think we agreed that there would be much less vulnerabilities in this case, but also substantially less software as well. So, thank you.
Okay, I'm Dan McCoy. I led the group on Yeeman factors. Yeeman factors is this very broad, expansive topic. So was our conversation in this. I began with a kind of a motivating example of how the landscape of spam advertising works and the customers, cyber attackers, and business model of this. And after I got done laying out this example of pharmacy, people said, okay, what's the problem? Customers are getting low-cost pharmaceuticals from cyber criminals. So this kind of outlines some of the problems that we're dealing with in security from a human factors thing, where, right, sometimes it's difficult to pick out who the victim is and if the cyber criminal is truly doing something malicious. And so once people were thoroughly convinced that, in fact, there was some malicious wrongdoing here, and that, in fact, this money that was flowing in from these illicit drugs was funding malware development and things like this, we began with the conversation on what we could do to perhaps improve this. And so one topic that we kept touching on in our discussion was this idea of cyber insurance. And whenever we touched on this idea, the first problem is that insurers are very reluctant to write riders for cyber insurance today. And so that led to the question of, okay, why are insurance companies very hesitant to get into this market where, as you see from all these vulnerabilities, there's more and more pent-up demand for the cyber insurance? So what's the holdbacks here? And kind of one of the key problems that we found is that there's insufficient data to model risk. And so insurance companies don't want to write large riders because of this issue. And so we touched upon this issue of perhaps it would be interesting if we as a community could start perhaps building up some equivalent to actuarial tables for cybersecurity. And so this would be a very highly useful thing to spur these kinds of riders. And the other limitation to the cyber insurance is that, right, we don't understand the distribution of payouts, which is a key thing for insurance companies. Is it going to be kind of a Katrina event where you're going to have to pay out for something like Heartbleed basically everywhere? Or is it going to be something where it's a more metered payout system? And so until we understand these things, this is kind of a moot problem. So these are interesting problems if someone wants to try and research these problems. Then we also touched on this issue of instead of, you know, just having users go through training, punishing them when they fail phishing exercises and things like this, maybe we can take this model of incentivizing users. And so someone tossed out this idea of, let's say, let's pay workers $5 if they do X to make themselves more secure. And then the issue came that, okay, what is the X that we want them to do to make them more secure? And then this led to the fact that, right, currently we don't really understand what produces good outcomes in terms of user behavior and security. We don't really know, does running AV improve your security? Does anyone know? Does running antivirus improve your security? Does getting good grades in your courses improve your security? Does losing weight improve your security? We don't really know what are the factors that will improve your security largely. So again, this is another interesting set of experiments that perhaps we could gain more knowledge in terms of what produces good security outcomes for users and potential victims. And the final topic that I'm going to talk about is something about teachable moments. So once we convinced people that, in fact, there were bad things happening in the pharmaceutical market, then how can we convince users not to purchase from these illicit pharmaceutical markets? And so this led to the idea of warning messages. And so right currently, Google pops up warning messages when you go to potentially dangerous sites. They do not pop up warning messages for things like pharmacy because that's not within the scope of their warning messages. So it'd be interesting to have some kind of warning message that perhaps explains to users why it might be dangerous. And then the final thing that we talked about was trying to encourage remediation. So the idea of notification, and again, understanding when notification is effective, what types of notification, who should notify users to perhaps have good security outcomes in terms of remediating problems. So those were the areas that we talked about.
All right, so I'm Edsel from Cornell. So I'll report back on the discussion we had about architecture. So first of all, architecture is a pretty broad term, so I want to kind of narrow down like what we mostly talked about. So in a highest level, the question here was what are the best opportunities for architecture level solutions for improving security and privacy compared to, say, individual mechanisms and so on. And the architecture here was fairly broadly defined, especially at the beginning, so hardware, software, networking, and so on. On the other hand, the discussion at the end ended up focused more on the opportunities there are for the hardware level architecture or how you can use both hardware and software to improve the security. So in that sense, kind of discussion started out as saying, what are the kind of benefits or strengths and weaknesses of hardware compared to software? What can it do, what it cannot do? So there are a few things that were pointed out. So first of all, the hardware is the kind of layer that actually talks to the physical world. So if you care about like real time, that's where your hardware needs to be involved. The hardware is also more difficult to bypass or difficult to tamper with change compared to purely software-based ones. So people mentioned things like a strong isolation. If you really want isolation, that hardware would be a good thing to do. And also it provides a higher performance or lower power consumption or better energy efficiency. So if you have things like Internet of Things where you really care about battery life and energy consumption, people felt the hardware level solution can really help. So those are kind of good things that we talked about. On the other hand, obviously the hardware doesn't really solve all the problems by itself. So there are obvious weaknesses like the hardware doesn't really know about what's going on at the higher level. So there's a gap in terms of semantics. And also, once you get something wrong in hardware, it's really much more difficult to fix it up. So in that sense, it was pretty obvious from this discussion that we really do not want to stay to everything in hardware. It was really an architecture question. How can hardware and software work together? And what is the best balance in terms of what's the right set of mechanisms that you want to put into hardware? What are the right things to do in the software and so on? And we talked about various kinds of ideas, and they're kind of all over the places. And I'm going to try to kind of highlight kind of major directions people talked about. So the idea that came up a lot when we talked about what can we change at architecture level, both hardware and software, was the idea of using the hardware to guarantee at least a really critical security and privacy properties that you really, really care about, even if multiple software layers gets compromised. So can we put something at the lowest level and get the guarantee, especially in the context of the safety critical applications and systems? And another thing was, so in order to do that, you know, to find out what's the right thing to do with the hardware was a really critical thing, and people felt we really need to better define our threat models and security requirements, for especially for emerging application domains, things like a smartphone, cloud, IoT, CPS, and so on. We don't necessarily have a really clear idea. And so we need some more work on that domain to really understand those things. And once you do that, it seems like right now the hardware architecture that we developed for previous kind of general platform was just apply for all these platforms in the same way. So we felt it's good to rethink the architecture we have in this new context. And those are kind of how the hardware software can help in terms of security. The other question that came up was how do you actually build the hardware itself more secure and with a higher assurance? So we need a new methodology, researching methodology in terms of improve both security and performance, kind of deal with the tension between two, and also in terms of the assurance for hardware software, we need a better tools and metrics to verify security of them. And another question that came up was things like, especially IoT, seems like security requirements and mechanisms we want changes from the application to application. So we probably need a better tools and platforms that allows you to quickly build the security and customize the security that you want. And in order to do that very well, it seems there's a disconnect between hardware and software people right now. So we need a better, more of a facilitation of the tight integration between two. And also one thing that came up was we need a better infrastructure and common infrastructure that you can use to do research in this domain and also encourage collaboration to other people to take a look at, say, assurance for hardware. All right, so I'll stop there.
Good afternoon, everyone. I led the breakout on cloud security, and there was some overlap in the attendees between this breakout and the one that Ed just talked about. So we started with talking about what it means for a cloud to be secure, privacy, integrity, obviously, but also there's many entities that use the cloud, there's third-party software vendors, there's the cloud service providers, and each of them has different notions of privacy, integrity, and overall security. We spent a bunch of time talking about how to resolve conflicts between availability, for example, user convenience, and the security properties that these different entities required. And we spent some time thinking about whether security technology was going to get squeezed out because of the requirement of availability, for example, or convenience, migration of software from one virtual machine or one physical machine to another, et cetera. And then we spent some time talking about what it is that people think is the trusted computing base of the cloud, obviously software components and hardware components, and research directions corresponding to minimizing the trusted computing base and why that was a good thing and how far we could push it. Some research directions that obviously were a function of the people in the room and their research interests, so by no means complete. Many interesting directions came up. We talked about the fact that it would be nice to know how to track your data, your sensitive data, through third-party software and potentially have access control over it. And one interesting thing that came up was that the user interface here with respect to interacting with the user, asking the user about whether to say yes or no about a particular access, it was going to be incredibly important because most of the time, you know, a menu pops up and you say yes. We talked about the fact that verifiable storage was, you know, seemed like a problem that was better handled by academic research, but verifiable computation and obfuscated computation were significantly harder just from a technical standpoint. There was a lot of discussion corresponding to hybrid cryptographic and system approaches, not necessarily heuristic security, but using the right technique for the job and deciding when to back off on cryptographic security, for instance. Some thought on security across users. Users could be malicious, obviously. The cloud service provider being malicious, it seemed like a less significant problem, but certainly a problem as well. But the fact that sharing of resources causes all sorts of trouble was something that we felt required research, more research, and needed to be addressed. Intel SGX is a commercial product that should come out this year, perhaps next year, and it certainly has a lot of promise with respect to isolating users from each other and not having to and shrinking the trusted computing base. And there's some documentation on it, but obviously this is something that should be kept track of from a research standpoint to see if we can enhance SGX and other commercial offerings. And then finally, we spent some time talking about resolving the conflict between obfuscated computation and actually allowing malicious users to run obfuscated computations that would hurt other users. So Ed mentioned this at the very end, and as I mentioned, there was some overlap in attendees. One thought that came up was it'd be nice to do some development at the open source level of a public secure cloud where you could imagine different settings where you had infrastructure as a service and platform as a service that have different trust models associated with them and different trusted computing bases associated with them, and perhaps build clean slate secure processor designs as well as exemplar software stacks and applications. And this would serve as something that would enable research and also serve as a community building exercise. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mingyan Liu from University of Michigan. Our discussion centered on machine learning, in particular, what are the risks, opportunities, and future research directions, good ones, when we apply machine learning to cybersecurity. As the discussion continues, obviously risks, opportunities are often embedded in each other, so I've organized a summary in terms of the actual subjects that receive more attention. So we started talking about some of the good uses and misuse of machine learning in this domain, and there's a general agreement that machine learning is a very powerful tool, but the successful stories often come with very good domain expertise, domain knowledge, so that they can guide us to frame the right problem, looking at the good problem with the right scope. And some not so good stories come from places where we try to apply machine learning in too broad a context. And there's also cautionary notes on overuse and superficial use of machine learning. It's easy to grab one of these tools, and you also have data, and just apply the tool to the data, and you get results. There it is. Without a deeper understanding of why you're getting what you're getting, what is the result telling us, and so on. So we have to be careful about this because it can create the perception of create in some domain that was mentioned a fatigue of hearing about using machine learning yet again in this and that problem. One trending subject in community machine learning, as you have seen in a crowdsourcdiscussion, is adversarial machine learning. And this is particularly relevant in the context of cybersecurity. The idea is as we use machine learning techniques to do detection and classification, an adversary, if he has this knowledge, he can manipulate his behavior and control the data to fool the machine learning algorithm that we use. And so this is very relevant. However, equally cautionary notes that was raised here is that when we talk about adversarial machine learning, we then have to address the issue of threat model. And as we have seen in some other areas of security, in some areas we ended up creating work based on speculative threat model rather than realistic threat model. So this is something we have to be careful about. I think very interesting subject that came up is the conflict between what we can do with machine learning and our desire for privacy. So the idea is as we are creating more and more powerful learning tools to obtain more, extract more information and do more inference on the data we have, the same capability in the hands of an adversary can basically make privacy issues even worse with all these publicly available data scattered around the network. And an analogy here is perhaps development of software without consideration for security, which only occurred as an afterthought. So this basically makes machine learning a double-edged sword. It's something that's worth consideration, and it's something that perhaps hasn't received enough attention in the community. One opportunity that was called out is perhaps a more focus on the explanation of the result of machine learning rather than or in addition to pursuing better and better performance. Now, the interpretation capability has never been a strong suit of machine learning. Sometimes it's perceived as a black box, numbers in, numbers out. It's not clear why we're getting what we're getting. And this is an opportunity for all involved to put more focus on interpretation and closer connection to the physical explanation. Finally, the issue of data came up, as you have seen in other breakout sessions. In order to apply machine learning techniques, we need data. And in a lot of cases, in order to get good results, we need high-quality data. A glaring issue here is the lack of ground truth. There is a split of opinion, I would say. On the one hand, not split of opinion. On the one hand, I think there's this desire for perhaps publicly funded distributed collective effort to come up with a data repository, high quality data like what happened in the medical sciences, medical research. The challenge here, however, is we live in a highly dynamic environment. A lot of the data become quickly obsolete. And the privacy issues, as well as the cost of maintenance. So we maybe will continue to live in an environment where we rely on very few industry-sponsored data sources or scrape data ourselves, or this is an opportunity for more creative thinking and different models for data collection. Thank you.
So I'm Ning Hui Li from Purdue University. I co-led this breakout group with Sumesh Jar. So we first talk about what are the unique challenges in the mobile platform. So one of them is now users need to be involved in many more decisions, like which software to install and what to allow. And so in a sense, we need to accommodate the different users' need, but we can't really rely on users making all kinds of security decisions. So there's an intense challenge there. And also, these mobile devices, they have all kinds of sensors. So they provide interesting new data that need protection. But the traditional operating system mechanism is not designed to protect extensible resources. So the type of resource is typically fixed. In particular, they are fixed on like a file system. We know how to protect them. But these new resources, it's unclear. And also, there are challenges in analysis. So naturally, we can apply static analysis to apps, so market can do that. But one challenge is analysis may not be accurate. But even if the analysis derive very accurate behavior of the apps, it's still unclear whether it's malicious or not, because whether an app is malicious or not is kind of depend on the context of the action taking place, and also depends on user tolerance. Some user may be fine with revealing certain information, but other user may consider that to be an attack. So that's another challenge. And also, the app market are highly fragmented, so any mechanism that you develop may not be applicable to sort of broadly applicable. So in terms of future research directions, so I organize them into two main directions. One is the macro level, what can be done at the app market and ecosystem. So we believe that it's necessary to have some either incentive or government structure to incentivize app market to promote security, which currently is not there. So for example, one member said, well, why can't I search for apps that do something without using all these permissions? And then later I learned actually some researcher is working on that problem. And also another suggestion is maybe we can have developers post 1 million bond before they can post apps in the market. So first, this is not in the interest of the app market to do so, and also how can we really provide a liability argument that's valid legally to say you have posted malware. And also, it's noted that malware on market, they also need this ad campaign to make it attractive to users. So maybe in addition to detecting malware, we can also detect those campaigns. And finally, there's also something market can do, something the client devices can do. So maybe the client devices can provide data that help the market. So we also studied how to help developers provide better apps. So if it's difficult to identify which are malicious, maybe we can identify what are good. Maybe we can have a set of hygiene rules that app developer can follow, and then they can provide certification that those rules are followed. So maybe new programming language can help provide this kind of proof-carrying app, if you will. Or maybe there's also the challenge between having the code for enable analysis, but also the developer want to prevent reverse engineering, maybe crypto can help there. And also we need a more flexible permission model that balance the need of expressive power and also the need of hide complexity from user. Finally, maybe new hardware features can help in this aspect.
Hello, my name is Roxana Jambashu, and I led the breakout session on securing the web for everyone. Thank you. We had open office issues. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Okay, so we were charged by Dave here with the following broad topic to discuss. The way we pitched it was, despite lots of technical advances, right, that we've made in the field of security and privacy for the web, most experience of most users, right, is in terms of security and privacy is very, very bad, right? And so the question is, what can the research community still do? Where can we improve things, right, in order to have immediate and longer term impacts on security and privacy of typical users? What are the remaining research issues, the remaining educational, to-do list, right, that we have to do? In this context, we actually addressed a number of questions. I'm not going to go through all of them here. Instead, I'm going to cherry pick a few of the questions that I believe led to some either compelling or concrete steps that I would like to pitch to you guys. I know that I would be very interested in tackling any of these particular research directions that and educational directions that came. So the first question that I actually started the breakout with was, I wanted to start with a positive note. So I asked the question, have any areas, right, in online security gotten better? The answer, right, was largely, yes, there are some areas that could be judged as, we're doing better. For example, there is now more seamless, auto updates, broader deployment of HTTP. Yes, broader adoption of fairly sophisticated and more secure, some would argue, authentication schemes like, two-factor authentication and so on. However, the question is really, are users, real users, more secure? Can we judge that? And unfortunately, that answer is we don't know. We have no idea. HTTPS might be more broadly deployed, but for example, now attacks are starting to arise more and more against PKIs, right? And so, the attack surface is the attack, right? Is switching to other areas now. Moreover, right, there is increasingly and more attractive information available online, either publicly or, in giant repositories like, these large web companies that are collecting a lot of information. So, these are honeypots, if you want, for attackers. And the worst part of it is that we can't measure, we don't know. And so the research direction, this is not very concrete. We didn't get it to a point where it's, concrete research directions, but I think it's a very, very compelling, broad research areas that we should be working on, is that we need longitudinal studies of how regular user security, privacy, right, online is evolving over time. Of course, for that, we need to invent, and develop a number of things, including metrics for security, which traditionally are hard, is a difficult topic, but it's been, researched quite a lot, especially in corporate settings. For example, there is corporate risk management. Can we apply, metrics, from that field, if you want, to regular users? So those are things that we discussed a little bit about, and you know, that I think are very worthy, you know, to pursue. Of course, we need data sets. We need methodologies for measuring, you know, security privacy. But I think that there are certain, you know, small steps that can be made that can, you know, add clarity with respect to how we're doing, right, and where we're improving. And this is probably how we can understand where we need, you know, more work to be done. The second, another question that we discussed a little bit, and that led to a more concrete, I would say, direction of research, is, you know, how do we increase users' perception of online risks, or rather, how do we align their perception better with the real risk that that they're facing? Right, you know, they're told that, well, you know, set a good, you know, a strong password because some attacker might, you know, might break it. But this is a very abstract way of informing users, and there is this belief, right, in our community that some of the security problems come in part from a lack of user understanding, right, of online risks and applying or being proactive about, you know, securing themselves because they don't really understand what they will be missing, what they will be losing. So the question is, you know, how do we increase that understanding? Well, you know, there were a number of ideas. I think one, you know, pretty interesting approach was, you know, to create a kind of a browsing assistant that watches, you know, users' online actions, classifies them based on their risks somehow. You know, again, metrics important. You know, we don't know concrete things here, and offers hints to users, you know, about ways to improve their activities in real time. Okay, and very concrete things. Okay. If you remember, right, the Microsoft Office paperclip, this is may not be the right abstraction to put here forth, because at least for me, it kind of annoyed me always when I saw that. But, you know, there have been success stories of this sort. For example, for password, right, there is this range, you know, password, you know, red to good to or bad to good, which have been pretty effective at, you know, convincing if real-time feedback is given at convincing users to take a better approach to this. Finally, I would like to just say that a very, very compelling direction that I would, you know, that we addressed very, very briefly is that we should, as a community, come up with a bunch of rules of thumb that we can communicate to users in simple ways. You know, we should record videos. We should somehow, you know, export these rules of thumb to them to increase their, you know, and of how they can increase their security. And, you know, we should come up with all of these. We are the best community to come up with, you know, these rules of thumb. I'm sure a lot of us have been asking, you know, have been asked, what can I do to improve my security? And there isn't, you know, in my opinion, a clear list that we can point them to.
Hello, I'm Stéphane Lafortune from the University of Michigan. I know you're probably pretty hungry, so I'll try to be brief. So in this session, we were discussing security issues in cyber-physical systems. And so we started by asking, what are really the differences in, from a point of view of security between cyber-physical systems and cyber systems, or for that matter, the Internet of Things? So it was noted that all cyber-physical systems have sensors and actuators, but they also have control feedback loops. And these actuators and sensors monitor physical variables. So the laws of physics come into the picture here. So the systems may have inertia. Timing may be very important. And in fact, we have to worry about physical consequences of improper behavior in cyber-physical systems, which is why safety is very important, and that means that graceful degradation and recovery are very important problems. So then we discussed what can be done in terms of finding aspects that have, or security aspects that have analogs in cyber systems from the point of view of cyber-physical systems. So it was noted that we should work on drawing parallels with network security, for example. Now, On the other hand, it was noted that we should also find aspects, security aspects, that do not have analogs in cyber systems and have research value, so that are not just engineering implementation considerations. So, and one of these issues is that both the defender and the attacker are limited by the laws of physics because the underlying system has this physical component. So then that brings in, therefore, control theory into the picture, as well as real-time and embedded systems. And in control theory, we're used to make, formal mathematical models of the underlying system, as well as dealing with well-defined specifications. And control theory use feedback loops are used to reduce the effect of external disturbances, but it was noted that the in the context of security, the attacker is not just a disturbance, but there may be a dynamic adversarial model to take into account. And it was also discussed that what should be the role of humans in these loops? Should there be more or less of involvement of humans at different stages? So it was also mentioned that the attacker may not simply be trying, well, simply, may not only be trying to do inflict damage on the system, but it may also be trying to acquire intellectual property, which is why it was emphasized that authentication of components is a very important issue. And regarding intrusion detection, isolation, and recovery, we noted that it's important to exploit here the sensor redundancy in the cyber-physical system as well as its physical model. And another issue that was emphasized was the importance of timeliness in responding to an attack, again, because of the underlying physical considerations here. And of course, we have a wide range of application domains, from critical infrastructure, so the big four, power, water, communications, transportation, to a wide range of cyber-physical systems, including just, for example, down to medical devices or biomedical devices and their interconnections. So there will be, of course, different considerations for these different classes of systems. And the so it was noted that security is still an afterthought. I know that's an often repeated theme this morning. And so what can we do as academics? Some of the issues that were mentioned were, for example, developing a taxonomy of potential vulnerabilities, getting involved in vulnerability assessment as a way of quantifying impact, do what-if analyses. For example, what if I have brought in security issues earlier into the design process? What would have the consequences been? And finally, scalability. And we only briefly discussed privacy in cyber-physical systems because this is actually very domain-specific. Thank you very much.
So my name is Portia Pusey, and I represent the National Cybersecurity Competition Federation, and our discussion was on cybersecurity competitions. I'm here representing Dan Manson, the PI. I'm a consultant who does leads research and education for very busy academics. So I have a recommendation for you, since I stand between you and lunch, and I only have two slides. I have some resources and some good information for you, and they're going to be up on a website that's currently in development. So I suggest you write down my name while I'm doing the my email address, while I write down the, while I introduce our work, and then at least we'll be one step ahead and closer to lunch. So cybersecurity, oh, I didn't leave time for you to do that, did I? The cybersecurity competitions embody just about anything you can imagine. If you're teaching it, if you're building it, if you are, if you're doing it, somebody's probably made a game out of it. And that's how we define these competitions, as activities and things that have been turned into games. They seem to be a good bridge for all the work that's been happening among the participants. And in the vein of our speed dating, I'd like to tell you some of the opportunities that I observed and my group observed at the same time that can strengthen our work as cybersecurity competitors and competition organizers, and strengthen your work as well. I see opportunities for the hat that you wear as technologists to partner with the competition developers, because you have a bunch of competitors and competition designers that want to put new technologies in the hands of these users. We're talking about kids who love to use new technologies and would be anxious to help and support your projects for the mere cost of pizza. They can help you solve real world problems, and they can bring you data sets. There's an opportunity for competition developers and technologies to collaborate with social science researchers. We have at our disposal, and I include myself in the social science researchers, ways to provide you with predictive instruments that might measure something that it would be helpful for you. We have ways of identifying outcomes for players and competitions, but what you could bring to us is you could help us bake measurement and information into the competitions. Finally, if you wear your educator hat, competitions provide you hands-on ways to put assessment in your classroom. Everything that your cybersecurity students are doing requires hands-on assessment. There are downloadable competitions and labs and things that are resources of the cybersecurity competition. Next comes my shameless plug for the people who were in my room and have NSF projects that can support you, your projects, and your teaching. IceRink is a resource that you can use. It's labs in a networking environment, cybersecurity and penetration testing, all within a competition environment. They have great projects planned to help your outreach in terms of high school and help you teach and test those concepts in your classroom. Remember, this is all NSF supported and it's all free. Handsonsecurity.org to support your teaching is a wonderful collection of resources that you can use in your classroom. Many of those projects are NSF supported, free curriculum, free labs. Cyberfed.org, that's where I'm working. Do not go to this website. It's right now it's in development. It will be good by the end of January. And finally, there's a great conference, USENIXT 2015, 2014 was it's gaming, gamification, and games in cybersecurity education. All of these will give you the hands-on tools that you need. So please write me. I'll send you an email when our website goes live. I will facilitate a Google Plus community for the Cybersecurity Federation, which can bring all of the technologists and all of the teachers together so that we can get these technologies and test your technologies in our classrooms.